Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
My name is Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to another edition of the LaRouche Connection. As many of you probably know, 3 years ago, through the intervention of Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan and the mandarins at the International Monetary Fund, talk about a new global financial architecture was short-circuited in favor of a series of hyperinflationary moves to avoid a major collapse of the international financial and monetary system. These moves by the Fed and the IMF occurred following a near two-year-long process of rolling economic crises that first hit Southeast Asia, then moved to Russia, and then moved hard into Latin America. And ultimately, in October of 1998, the entire international financial system was almost brought down as the result of the collapse of just one hedge fund, Long-Term Capital Management. Yet, the Fed and IMF at that time insisted that the existing system was fundamentally sound and merely required reforms and adjustments, and of course, a massive flood of liquidity that created near hyperinflationary conditions in the United States and elsewhere. Now, 3 years later, we are faced worldwide with an even more severe meltdown of the entire international financial system. In recent weeks, the manifestations of that global crisis have played out in Argentina, which, as we speak today, is on the verge of a $130 billion default in debt. The Argentine crisis has spread to Brazil. Turkey is going through a currency meltdown, and there is fear that the contagion will very rapidly spread into Mexico, into the United States, and then become the seeds of a new global meltdown of proportions that nobody right now is prepared to deal with few very rare exceptions, the leading exception being Lyndon H. LaRouche, Jr. This is the backdrop for this week's edition of the LaRouche Connection. On August 2nd, Mr. LaRouche delivered a presentation before an audience of more than 350 people gathered in Mexico City at the major international conference center there. The event was sponsored by the Association of Public Accountants for the Public Interest, an organization associated with the pre-party but representing the major state sector public accountants, and many leading Mexican economists, elected officials, former cabinet ministers were there in the audience to hear Mr. LaRouche and to ask questions. Mr. LaRouche delivered his presentation via a teleconference. Mr. LaRouche was in Frankfurt, Germany at the time that the event took place. And what we will be joining in progress in just a moment is Mr. LaRouche's main presentation before the body and then some representative questions that took place during an event that ran for nearly 2.5 hours.
A few days ago, the leading Swiss financial press, the Zürcher, Neue Zürcher Zeitung, published a report which was echoed a few days later in other publications in Europe. The report was a study of Argentina stating that the only solution for the present crisis of Argentina, which of course is still going on, would be a debt moratorium. That view was then endorsed by other parties, not in the U.S., but in other parts of Europe. That is a correct assessment, but Argentina is not the only country which faces such a problem at this time. We have Brazil, which is in a similar crisis. Turkey's in a similar crisis. Poland's crisis is worse than that of Turkey or Argentina in terms of magnitude. Around the world, the same thing is true. The world is now in a depression, a world depression, which in certain of its characteristics is worse than that of the 1930s, the early 1930s. This is not something which is about to happen. It is something which has already happened. The effects are yet to be seen fully, but it's in progress. There is no bottom to this depression. As long as the present system continues to operate, the present IMF system, the depression will get deeper and deeper and deeper. There's no solution within the terms of this system. Now, however, at present, you have a desperate effort on the part of the United States, the government of the United States, the Federal Reserve System, and other institutions around the world to pretend either that there is not a depression going on or that there will soon be a bounce back from that depression to a new period of recovery, prosperity, whatever. That will not occur. This is not a cyclical crisis. It is a systemic crisis. That is, things that happened 35 years ago and so forth are now coming home to roost. In the post-war period, for example, from 1945 until after the death of Kennedy, we had a system which is based partly upon the influence of President Franklin Roosevelt in designing the Bretton Woods system. And the system functioned to some degree in the Americas and in relations with Western Europe and Japan. Beginning in the middle of the 1960s, we went into a new system, which was established firmly in 1971 with the collapse of the dollar, the beginning of the so-called floating exchange rate system. And from that time on, we've been in a system that does not work and will not work. But that's the way with economics. Systems that don't work when they take over nations or parts of the world do not generally collapse all at once. For a time, the world goes on. Business as usual seems to go on. And then at some point, the system begins to fall apart. And then it comes to a point of breakdown, which is what we reach now. Now, over the course of years, especially the past decade, the world has been run by the United States and Britain, especially by some powerful financier circles in the United States and Britain. And therefore, people tend to look to the United States as the largest individual nation-state power in the world for guidance in dealing with any kind of international crisis, and certainly a world depression, a breakdown of the present monetary and financial system, is a world crisis. The problem is that we have a president and a presidency in the United States which does not function. Now, I wouldn't say that Bill Clinton did an excellent job in handling the crisis that was coming on under his term. But while Bill Clinton and Bob Rubin, as Secretary of Treasury, were on board, the world thought that at least somebody in Washington would respond, and respond positively, if not successfully. What has happened is since the new administration, since the last election of last November 7th, the United States has been in a permanent political crisis. And the present administration has policies that will not work, that cannot work. And only when we reach a point that those policies are changed, that is when the president of the United States changes his policy profile, then we could begin to expect a rational form of response to the crisis from the United States. Now, of course, the United States is not the only nation in the world. We have some very positive developments in other parts of the world, in the former Soviet Union, for example, in Russia. Russia has reached agreements with the nations of East and South Asia, increasing number of such agreements, which are very good agreements that tend in a direction toward cooperation among these states in Eurasia. Also in Western Europe, Italy and Germany, for example, and to some degree France, and other nations are in discussion with Russia and with nations in the Far East and Southeast Asia and so forth in this direction. This is all very good. There are some people, if there were no war about to break out in the Middle East right now, then you would have initiatives from Egypt to cooperate with the Eurasian development programs underway. These new programs could become the basis for a revival of the world economy. But we cannot save the present world monetary system. The problem is this. The crisis we have is not a cyclical crisis. This is not a crisis like 1929, 1931. This is a systemic crisis. That is, it's a breakdown of the system, which means the system has reached the point that if you try to continue the system, or try to continue the world economy under the system, the world economy will simply break down. No recovery of the world economy or of any of the nations in it will ever occur under the present monetary and financial system. A new system is required. And that is precisely what the government of the United States at present and some other governments in the world are not yet ready to consider. We have from Italy, leading parliamentarians there and others have made motions in the direction of general debt reform and other types of reform. Other parts of the world are interested in these kinds of reforms. We've had a proposal from Japan for reform, for an Asia Monetary Fund by Mr. Sakaki Barra some years ago. That proposal is still active. We have proposals from Malaysia and with much sympathy from China, proposals from Korea, and so forth and so on. So there are proposals for change. There are proposals for cooperation, but there is yet no agreement among a sufficient number of governments to decide to pull down and put the present financial system, the present monetary system, into bankruptcy reorganization. Until that happens, the world is simply going to become worse. Now, this is not an impossible problem to deal with. At the beginning of the last century, before World War I, already numbers of leading economists were considering the hypothetical condition under which the entire financial system might break down. They called it a breakdown crisis, as distinct from what was called a cyclical crisis. And they thought about it, and there were various discussions of this. Now let's look back at what this crisis is, this systemic crisis now, and how it began. Go back to the end of the last war, when Franklin Roosevelt, in the Bretton Woods Conference, had introduced proposals for global reforms for the post-war period. Despite his death, many features of that program were continued as the post-war Bretton Woods system. They were continued in the Americas to a large degree. They were continued in relations between the United States and Western Europe and with Japan and some other cases as well. During that period, from 1945, at the end of the war, until approximately the middle of the 1960s, the then-present monetary system worked. It worked fairly well. There were many injustices under it. There were many things wrong with it. Many countries suffered discrimination under it. But the system as a whole worked in the sense that overall, the parts of the world involved in that system improved in their productivity, the standard of living, and the general expectations for life. A change came about the same time that President Kennedy was assassinated, in 1963. That was the year in which Konrad Adenauer, the Chancellor of Germany, was told to take an early retirement. That was the year in which Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, was told to take a walk with the Profumo scandal. That was the year that the first attempt at assassination of President Charles de Gaulle of France occurred. And after the assassination of Kennedy, and after the effects of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, the world began to change suddenly for the worst. The change started for the worst in about 1964 with the advent of the Harold Wilson government in England, which is almost, we might call it, the Jimmy Carter government of England of the 1960s. He wrecked everything in sight. About the same time, the United States became involved in a useless and hopeless and worthless war in Indochina. This had effects on the overall system. In 1967, the world monetary system began to disintegrate with the Harold Wilson government's revaluation of the pound sterling. The revaluation of the pound sterling in 1967 led to the crisis of the dollar in February and March of 1968. During the same period, the United States began to change. Several changes occurred. You had the 68 phenomenon, which is in part a reaction to these missile crisis and other changes which had demoralized the up-and-coming post-war generation, but otherwise also at the same time. There was a general deterioration in the economic process and the political process. The campaign of Richard Nixon for President of the United States was a disaster because Nixon introduced what was called the Southern Strategy. Let me just explain briefly what that is, because it's important to understand the Southern Strategy, to understand many of the problems that arise in relations between the United States and the nations of South America and Central America, and many of the problems today. In the history of the United States, we've had two basic tendencies. We can typify these by presidents. President Washington represents my tendency, what is called the American intellectual tradition of Benjamin Franklin and so forth. That same tendency is represented by President Monroe, by President John Quincy Adams, who at one point was Secretary of State and later a congressman. We had the continuation of the John Quincy Adams tradition with Abraham Lincoln. And the people in Mexico remember who Abraham Lincoln was in terms of relations. We also had presidents who were on another side. The other side were a group of bankers, usually tied to London, often centered in New York, typified by Aaron Burr, who was in fact a traitor of the United States and once vice president, and he was the founder of the Bank of Manhattan. And the Aaron Burr tradition, together with the Southern slave-owning plantation owners, created what became known in due course as the Confederacy. This tendency in the United States was known as the American Tory tradition, as Franklin Roosevelt described it during his second term of office as president. Now, what Nixon represented was the American Tory tradition, which was a change from the American intellectual tradition, which John F. Kennedy represented, as did Franklin Roosevelt before him. So under Nixon, we had the Southern Strategy. The Southern Strategy, which got into motion in 1966 as part of Nixon's campaign for the presidential election, was an alliance of President Nixon personally, or candidate Nixon then, with the Ku Klux Klan and similar kinds of racists, including Trent Lott, who is presently the Republican leader of the Senate. So this tendency, together with a radically liberal tendency in economics, the so-called Milton Friedman model or Friedrich von Hayek model, what we have today, began to take over. The commitment to development of infrastructure, the commitment to improvement of the conditions of life of the poor, the promotion of freedom and betterment of social relations and rights, the relations to nations in South and Central America, began to deteriorate at an accelerating rate as Nixon moved on to become the president and as he was president. And then in Nixon in 1971 sank the remains of the old Bretton Woods system with his April 1971 decision, April 15th, we're close to that anniversary now, and sank the system. Since that time, especially as you can see in Ibero-America, from Mexico on south to the Cape Horn, there's been a systemic looting and destruction of the once proud republics of the Americas to the south, Hispanic and Portuguese republics, been looted under the floating exchange rate system. Currencies have been arbitrarily sunk by market speculation. Then the IMF and other agencies come in and say, devalue your currency. The countries say, okay, we'll devalue our currency. But then the IMF and others come in and say, but you must increase your debt obligations to cover the potential losses to your creditors from devaluing your currency. And therefore you have a situation in South and Central America under which South and Central America together have since 1971 more than repaid everything they ever borrowed or incurred as an obligation from the debts incurred up to this time. But they have also now a greater debt than ever before because of a particular type of IMF arithmetic launched under the floating exchange rate system as opposed to the fixed exchange rate system, which has caused this kind of crisis in this part of the world. We have silly all over the world. Great injustice. We are no longer committed, as we were, to the improvement of the average physical conditions of life, to investment in basic economic infrastructure, to encouraging national sovereignty, that is, sovereign projects, to encouraging the development of high technology industry, through improving trade with under protected terms, under that is, under protectionist kinds of conditions which are required for the growth of industries and countries. So we had a system which is no longer based on building the productive powers of labor and on building the productive powers of labor in terms of the population as a whole. And thus gradually, as more and more financial speculation and capital gains on financial speculation replaced the former system that worked, we have built up over approximately 35 years a system that does not work. That system is today collapsing. We have untold trillions of hundreds of trillions of dollars of debt obligations outstanding. We have a collapsing world economy. We have collapsing industries, collapsing agriculture. We can never pay those debts under presently scheduled conditions. Never. If we try to pay the debts, we will find that we will cost us more to pay the debts than we can possibly earn under present conditions. And therefore, the world is bankrupt. I can tell you frankly, the banking system, central banking system of the United States is bankrupt. I've documented, I won't go into the details, but the United States banking system is presently bankrupt. And if you want to know why the United States sometimes behaves the way it does, that's one of the reasons. The banking system of Western Europe is bankrupt. The telecom speculation, the so-called new economy speculation, has really aggravated this beyond belief, Western Europe. So therefore, we've come to the point that we have nations which we wish would function. We have collapsing employment in the United States. We have a beginning of a movement of capital, financial capital, out of the dollar into Western Europe again, as the United States is losing its position. So the Japan is bankrupt, the second largest monetary economy in the world. And around the world, virtually every nation in the world today, with the exception of China and probably, is bankrupt. Therefore, what we have to do, as many of you as accountants and financial advisors would do if you had your druthers, as they say, is we have to put the system into bankruptcy reorganization in the same way that we would put a bankrupt enterprise which was of national importance through bankruptcy reorganization. The same way we will take a bank which is essential to the national interest, and even if it's bankrupt, we will put it through bankruptcy reorganization and protection to bring it back as the kind of institution we need in the national interest. We will protect and restore national industries, which are essential to the nation. We will protect and restore farmers, because food production is essential to the nation. We will provide bankruptcy protection, and that's what we're going to have to do. Now, here's where the rub comes. All of us who can calculate and know economics, given the facts of the situation, would advise the world in the same way that we would advise a client in a private firm or a private bank, look, you're bankrupt. Let's put you through bankruptcy reorganization and save this enterprise through bankruptcy reorganization. We would say, do the same thing to nations. Do the same thing to the world monetary and financial system. Put it through bankruptcy, for the purpose of saving the nations, of saving the human population. But then when you say that today, then somebody starts screaming, especially around governments, and saying, you can't do that. People have their debts. The creditors have their assets. You've got to pay them. And you say, well, we can't pay them and keep the human race alive. What do you propose? And they scream a lot. Now, there are a lot of people in the world, a surprising number, and I talked to some of them, who would agree with me, this system requires bankruptcy reorganization. The problem is, How do we get it? How do we get bankruptcy reorganization? Well, what's going to happen is this. A number of us who are influential, whether in government or out of it, are going to have to meet and discuss. We're going to discuss this problem, and we're going to go step by step in a professional way through the measures that have to be taken to save these economies and to save the world trade system. We're out to save world trade, save the economies, save the nations, whatever it takes, like patriots in war. We're out to save the nation, whatever it takes. We're going to say, what do we have to do? Well, what we're generally going to recommend is freeze the unpayable financial assets. And the second thing we're going to do is ensure that present employment, especially essential employment, continues, production continues, that pensions obligations are met, that firms stay in business, that bankrupt banks, if they're bankrupt, will stay functioning for the needs of the community, for the protection of the depositors and things of that sort. And we're going to freeze everything else. We are then going to find a way to create a new mechanism of credit through national governments and their cooperation. And we're going to pour credit into the system for highly specified purposes. Now, for example, infrastructure. In the relationship between the United States and Mexico, for example, Mexico has a great deficiency in infrastructure. The railroad system, the general energy distribution system, the water management. If Mexico is to realize its potential, it requires a tremendous amount of infrastructural development. It requires a lot of internal increase in employment, that is for internal consumption, largely based on infrastructure. The United States, Mexico, and countries to the south must cooperate in this kind of undertaking. We must use an infrastructure building drive while we're trying to maintain the levels of employment and production, to use an infrastructure drive, long-term infrastructure development, 20, 25 years, in order to create a base for rebuilding the economy. Now, let's take the case of what we propose in Eurasia. I've been involved, as some of you know, recently in Russia, in testifying before the Duma Economics Committee on this matter. And this is not actually a new point of discussion. We've been discussing this in Eurasia for some time. I raised this question of reorganization of a post-Soviet system world in 1988 in an address I gave, which was televised later in the United States, an address I gave at Berlin in October 1988.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Since that time, I've been pushing projects, such as the European Productive Triangle Project, a development project of this type. This included Russia at that time as a proposal. We extended this to include China and other countries as this kind of proposal. We recognize that Western Europe, to revive and from its present bankrupt condition, must have larger markets of the type suitable to Western Europe. These markets exist largely in Asia, China, Southeast Asia, South Asia, Japan, so forth. So if these countries cooperate in creating a new system, we can, through large-scale infrastructure development projects involving the cooperation of these countries, we can rebuild the world economy, rebuild it rapidly. My aim is to have the United States come to its senses and participate in that kind of cooperation with Asia. We have programs which involve today Egypt, which is interested in going in that direction, to participate in this Eurasian cooperative project. And Egypt will play a key part in bringing development into more of Africa, especially the north-south aspect of Africa. We have the same kinds of ideas which are on the table waiting to be implemented. for the Americas. They've been on the table for over 20 years now on this level. So the United States should, in its own interest, agree to participate with these nations in Asia, Europe, and other parts of the world who realize that they must put the present system into bankruptcy and launch a new system. Well, what has to happen is, first of all, those of us who are, shall we say, more sensitive to reality and who have some expertise must meet and discuss. And we, through our discussions, must reach out very rapidly to educate other people, including politicians. I mean, you imagine what happens when you talk to a typical, say, American politician, even some of the more intelligent ones in the U.S. Senate, for example, who are sometimes I find them problematic. They can think, but you have to do a little work on them to get them to think clearly. They have other considerations, political considerations. You have to say, that you say to them, we're going to put the system through financial bankruptcy. The first thing they'll do is they'll scream. They'll shriek. They may run out of the room. They may do all kinds of strange things. Huh? They may go to their psychiatrist, whatever. But then you say to them, come on, sit down. We're saying you have to put the thing through bankruptcy. Let's go through it step by step. Suppose you decide not to put it through bankruptcy. What is going to happen? And you have to get them to face the reality of what happens to the United States in this world if they don't do it. And therefore, to do that kind of educational job, we must bring together influential people, sometimes senior political figures and so forth. And we have some in the room here today. These kinds of people to sit down and lay out among themselves what they should tell the people in political positions on a broader basis what to do to deal with this world crisis. This is not a national crisis. This is a world crisis. This requires strong national leaders, but it requires strong national leaders who are going to work together for global solutions. Not globalization, but global solutions. For example, if all banking systems and so forth are bankrupt, how do you create credit? There's only one way to create credit. It's called national banking. Only the state, if the state puts a system through financial reorganization, a sovereign nation state has the intrinsic moral authority under natural law to create credit against the nation itself and to use that credit both as purchase credit and also in some part in terms of national currency and to control the use of that in order to cause a flow of funds into things that are absolutely essential to make the economy move. Today, however, you can't do that simply on one nation at a time. You must have a number of nations in parallel meet, agree to do the same kind of thing, and then also agree to peg their currencies to a system of fixed parities, such as we established under the old Bretton Woods system between 1945 and the middle of the 1960s. Under those conditions, we can then, under a system of fixed parities, and low borrowing costs, I'm talking 1 to 2%, we can issue a system of 25-year credit, long-term loans, largely for infrastructure and long-term capital investment, which we can put on the world market through trade agreements and get this world economy not only back on its feet, but growing. For example, what is China trying to do right now? Just an example of optimism. China recently, in Germany, Zhu Rongji, the Prime Minister of China, went up to Emsland in Germany. It's where they have a test track where they run a magnetic levitation equivalent or substitute for railroad. This thing can run at 300 kilometers an hour, actually more, and it's fully tested and workable. Germany intended to have such a system for its own use, for its reviving its own railroad system into a magnetic levitation system railroad. But that was almost shut down. Emsland was about to shut down. So Zhu Rongji was up in Emsland at the test track. I was there a short time later. And he decided that his country, China, was interested in this project. And the head of the government of Shanghai in China, decided that this project should be bought by China, that China would begin by building a transrapide, that is a magnetic levitation system, from Shanghai City to the Shanghai Airport. A similar proposal was made for Beijing. The Shanghai project is now in progress. It's now operational. A magnetic levitation rail system will be operational from Shanghai to Shanghai Airport. It is also planned to connect the Shanghai development to the Beijing development. Now, China is going to have, in the year 2008, is going to have a World Olympics contest, International Olympics. And by that time, China intends to have, in many cities of China, routes which are magnetic levitation systems. We have large-scale plans to build transportation corridors, with transportation systems, across Eurasia, from Japan all the way to Rotterdam in Europe. We have three routes at least planned, and possibly a fourth. Russia has agreed to develop a rail link with Japan between East Russia in Asia and the islands of Japan. Today, as the Prime Minister, the head of state of North Korea, rises in Russia, there will be a discussion about completing, with Russia and South Korea cooperation, the rail link from Busan, which is at the southern extremity of South Korea, all the way through North Korea, among the old routes, into the Chinese system and the Russian system, which means you can go by rail then and transport the passengers as well from Busan in South Korea across Eurasia to Rotterdam. That's the kind of thing. There are many other kinds of projects. Similar projects planned by India and cooperating nations. Similar things are being discussed in Southeast Asia, as well as many other projects in China. So the world is ready where the largest concentration of world population is, in China, Southeast Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and so forth. This is a great market if the credit is available on long term at low rates to sell and deliver technology required by these countries into these nations. These nations will grow. They will be able to meet their obligations on the basis of this long-term credit. And nations such as those in Western Europe, Russia, the Americas, can grow. We can do the same thing in the Americas. The Americas have tremendous resources. Tremendous natural resources are sitting throughout the Americas, South and Central America, largely untapped because of an underdevelopment infrastructure. With adequate infrastructure development, these areas, which are potentially rich in natural resources, can become usable by mankind. And where you have a thinly populated hemisphere or subcontinent in South America, tremendous potential for growth exists, similar to the kind of thing which is possible in Eurasia. So we have before us the prospect, if we're willing to get rid of a bankrupt system, put it through bankruptcy, learn the lessons that we should have learned by comparing our experience from the period 1945 to about 64, and since, we should be able to devise, on the basis of proven precedents, the kind of policy programs, the kind of cooperation, which can get the world out of its present crisis and put us on the basis for recovery. But as I said, what is needed is people like some of you here today in this meeting, and me and others, to begin taking our responsibility, an urgent responsibility, to discuss among ourselves, to clarify our own minds on exactly what the right bankruptcy reorganization program is for this sick planet. Then we, in turn, must educate the relevant political force and others, and the population generally, that this is what we must do. We must make clear to them what the alternatives are of doing it and what the alternatives are, the penalties of not doing it. On that basis, I'm optimistic about the human race. You know, when you look at the world as a scientist, you realize that every great discovery in science came from discovering that what people believed up to that time was false, was wrong. That popular opinion was wrong. And no scientific discovery was ever made by popular opinion. But sometimes scientific discoveries, to our good fortune, re-educate popular opinion. And that's the way it is in politics. We face a situation which for many people is strange and frightening. Those of us who are older and wiser understand it. We understand in general how it has to be done. We have to look at the lessons of the past and devise a program for the future, as any scientist does in a crisis. And under those conditions, I think we should be optimistic. We should say, for 35 years in particular, the world has been acting like a pack of fools, especially in the Americas and in Western Europe. We've been acting like a pack of fools. Well, maybe we've now discovered that we were a pack of fools. And by discovering that fact, maybe we can cause ourselves to cease to be a pack of fools. And maybe, therefore, the suffering which we are now facing can become for the future something our coming generation will look back upon as a great blessing. People will be thankful that we suffered this way, because only if we suffered this way will we be likely to come to our senses and do what we should have done. Thank you.
This is a translation into English for Mr. LaRouche. The brief summary of the question is that we listened to your remarks thanks to some of the advances of technology, which seems to have been resolved. However, there are still remaining problems, and unfortunately we haven't been able to have the kind of fluid exchange that would have been appropriate. Your discussion on the development of the Bretton Woods system from 1945 to 1965 explained that the model was exhausted and the political developments that led into this. We will hear from some of the people who are involved in this current system at a future point. Concretely, my question is, what is your idea about the ability that we might have to reconfigure the IMF to establish a new credit scheme, which, as I understand it, would be not of a global world bank, but of new national banks, and that these would detonate development? How could this be done, and can we maintain stability under these circumstances?
That is largely a political question. Because if the world realizes, as it, how serious the problem is, and I think at this point the world is only beginning to realize what the situation is. Those of us who are in a more advantageous position know how bad the situation is. People will naturally, until people see alternatives, they tend to deny reality. It's like the person faced with death from a disease, the tendency to deny the reality of that that problem. So unless you give people optimism, they generally will not want to face reality, or they will simply go berserk and angry because they don't see any future for themselves. So those two political factors are crucial. The people must see reality. But on the other hand, they will not see reality unless they see positive alternatives to the present situation. And therefore, as you see in the case of, say, O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary of the United States, a man who is clinging to it unreality. The man is almost clinically insane. He's denying reality. Lindsay, the other advisor of Bush on economics, is probably a little more cold-blooded about it. But denying reality, people denying reality. And as I say, first of all, they have to face reality, but they're not likely to face reality until they see a positive alternative to the crisis. That's one of the characteristics of leaders, is great leaders are those who give the people the courage to face reality because they give them the optimism to face reality. For example, the most famous remark at the beginning of his term of office of President Franklin Roosevelt in the Depression was, he said to the American people, "We have nothing to fear as much as fear itself." And therefore, the uncertain It says in the, I don't like to quote the Old Testament at all, but in Isaiah there's a famous statement that if the trumpet shall sound an uncertain note, who shall heed the call to battle? And that's the situation we're in. We need leadership. We're not getting it. We're getting some good signs of leadership. Putin, for example, the president of Russia, is noted by most people around the world who are watching closely as a man who's acting like a leader. A few other people around the world are acting as leaders. Most parts of the world, people who are in positions of leadership are not acting as leaders. This is the problem that President Bush faces in the United States. He is not able to act as a leader, at least not yet. And therefore, when you don't have a leader who is capable of saying, this is the problem, but here is the solution, then the people will tend to be frightened and they will cling to illusions. Once the reality of this is seen, and once the alternative to the ugly reality is also seen from the voice of a concert of clear leaders, I think it will be not difficult to go back and show people, here's what happened under the old Bretton Woods system. Say, take the period 1945 to 1958, which was the most difficult period of recovery from the post-war, even post-war reconstruction. And look at what we did and how successful we really were relative to the problem. And people see that and say, well, why can't we do that again? We face a situation which, in certain terms, financially, is comparable to the situation Europe and other parts of the world face at the end of the Second World War. If it worked then, why can't we do the same thing again? So that on the question of a Bretton Woods system, my view has been, though there are many kinds of systems I could conceive of, designs, which would work for this, I have said, since we're making a shocking new turn in world monetary affairs, we have to appeal to the best possible precedent for our current actions so that people will have confidence in what we're proposing. They will trust us because they say, you're doing something that we understand did work. So let's do that again, and let's adjust what worked in the past to the special circumstances we face today. Under those circumstances, what it requires is simply a very simple conference. For example, one leading member of the Italian Senate has just proposed such a conference among Europeans. Let's take such a conference, have a special committee of experts, work with such a conference of international government officials, parliamentarians. Let these experts report to that parliamentary group immediately on something like a Bretton Woods proposal. Let them explain to everyone what it is. Let them agree among themselves what the options are. Let's recommend something today which fits the same requirements that the Bretton Woods system fit then, and take it back and say, this may not be perfect, but here's a start. That would mean national banking in every country. The central banks are bankrupt. What do you do? When a central bank is bankrupt, that is the private controlled chartered bank of a country, you create a national bank as Alexander Hamilton proposed. Mexico can make a national bank. The idea of national bank is not a strange thing in Mexico, in its Mexico's history. A national bank. Put everything under bankruptcy reorganization. A special commission of government to handle the internal effects of the bankruptcy. Special treaty arrangements among governments to handle the international aspects of bankruptcy reorganization. Freeze what you cannot reorganize, but keep the economies going. Create a national banking system. Now, by treaty agreement among governments, create a new international replacement for the IMF. As a matter of fact, legally, the IMF is nothing but a creature of governments. It's bankrupt, so therefore let the governments take over responsibility for the IMF and simply give it a new mandate to operate under these terms. Then we can have agreement among countries, negotiate trade agreements, do the obvious thing first, and it will work. In that sense, actually, the Bretton Woods system, with some insight into how it worked and some revisions which are fairly obvious, reinstituted today, would work as a start for the first year or two of bringing the crisis under control and starting to build a new system. That would give us a year or two of not leisure, but at least leeway, to begin to refine the system and put the institution into regularly functioning form. So I don't think the problem is as difficult as it seems. I think the problem is one, is people don't see how you could get governments and institutions to change their minds about their present views on policy. I think once the crisis is clear, and the crisis will only be clear to people when they see the alternative, at that point, the alternatives will become clear and people will be willing to go along with the needed changes, just as many people in the United States were willing to go along with the changes that Franklin Roosevelt put in, not without some difficulty and not without resistance.
It's always very interesting to hear your remarks, especially the discussion of infrastructure. We certainly lack modern infrastructure, and your remarks of how this will increase employment in countries such as Mexico are quite to the point. At the moment, we have in Mexico a government which is extremely timid in taking up its responsibilities, and it's trying to ask the private sector to do everything. My questions have to do with your proposal for reorganizing the global financial system. There are, of course, also other proposals, such as those of George Soros, with whom I know you have disagreements, but I'd be interested in your comments with regard to what those differences are. So that's the first question, the differences on the reorganization. The second, I would like you to discuss what the effects would be in Ibero-America, of Central and South America, of the development of the Eurasian land bridge proposal, which you have promoted. What would happen here? What would be the results for us? Because it seems to me we would be hurt by this development there because there would be a concentration of world capital in those markets. It would hurt ours, and our current problems of world trade would simply increase. So if you could answer those two questions, I'd be very appreciative.
Well, the Soros system is the one that ruined Russia and has ruined a great number of other countries. And I think it speaks for itself. In that respect, its effects are exactly what we don't want. If you look at the catastrophes which have happened in Eastern Europe and the Americas, where Soros has intervened over the period, say, between 1992 and the present, you would have to say that anybody in their right mind wouldn't want a Soros proposal of the type he's made heretofore in that country. You had the response by the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mohammed bin Mahathir, on that subject. I think it speaks for itself. Now, there is no danger, in my view, on the Eurasian land bridge to Ibero-America. First of all, the problem in Ibero-America is largely what is imposed as internal conditions on Ibero-America. For example, Brazil has no independent energy supply except the Amazon and other water systems. It's been denied access to other systems. It's forced to buy gas as an imported energy source from other countries, but under the control of Anglo-American interests. So Brazil has no. What's been done to Argentina is horrible. And we could go through the list of what the situation in various countries. If these countries are given back their full sovereignty, which they've been denied under these present international monetary and financial conditions, they themselves will tend to grow. I know that Brazil has the temperament it wants to grow. And we used to have this kind of rivalry between Mexico and Brazil about which was the country of the below the United States, below the Rio Grande, which is going to grow the most rapidly. We also had a certain rivalry with Argentina on that business. Each of these countries, Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina, each had, in the post-war period between 1945 and 1964, tremendous potential for growth. Endemic. For example, the development of cooperation among these countries in the hemisphere on a new basis would itself cause a great internal benefit. Now, for example, let's take the case of food supplies. Brazil produces food on which Japan largely depends. Also, Brazil and South and Central America have rich resources which, if developed with infrastructure development, are potentially of world importance. So there is no doubt of what can be done. In the case of Mexico, the big advantage, of course, of Mexico is Mexico is close to the United States, which can be a disadvantage for Mexico or a benefit, as many Mexican leaders have said many times, and with justification on both counts. But Mexico's development is essential to the security of the United States. And therefore, any president of the United States who has any sense is going to help Mexico in every way possible for with its internal development. The United States should not be in the business of exploiting Mexican labor going into the United States, so that should not be excluded. But rather, the function of the United States in its self-interest is to help Mexico develop its own internal market, largely with infrastructure, and with long-term agreements which promote the development of industries which are suitable to Mexico and improve the agriculture. For example, Mexico's water system. Mexico has had since how long? Since the struggles for independence has had an idea of development of two large water systems to take water from the plentifully supplied south and move it north to develop the agriculture. The agricultural potential with water development and energy in Mexico is tremendous. And therefore, the interest of the United States, in the case of Mexico, is to develop the internal potential of Mexico to assimilate its large labor force in a labor force of growing productivity and domestic strength. The interest of the United States is the same thing in Brazil, the real interest. Let Brazil develop. Get the NGOs out of there. And let Brazil develop its own country in a Brazilian way, grandiose as it may seem to some others. Let Argentina recover. So under this kind, the kind of world that a Eurasian cooperation would mean would be the kind of world which would, by its very nature, contribute to the benefits for all of Central and South America in terms of opportunities, provided, of course, that the United States behaved itself.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.